You guys are really too much, and I want to introduce you to the guys individually in the Who, because you never get to know their names. So what's your name?
Pete.
Pete, and where are you from, Pete?
London.
You know, that's a wild style of playing. Where'd you learn to play the guitar like that?
That was bowling.
Yeah, I could tell. Now we move right along, right over here, and you're,
John.
You're John?
John, from London, sir.
And you must be Roger.
I must be.
And where are you from?
Oz.
And over here, the guy plays a sloppy drum. What's your name?
Keith.
What's the next song you're going to do?
My Generation. People try to put us to talk down the generation. Just because we
I'm Brian O'Donnell. On December 3rd, 1979, rock and roll fans streamed onto the plaza of Riverfront Coliseum in downtown Cincinnati to see The Who, one of the world's most famous bands at the time. While fans were waiting to get in, the crush of the crowd left 11 young music fans dead. The response by the city of Cincinnati to The Who concert tragedy that night revolutionized the way concerts and crowds are handled around the world. Tonight, a look back to December 3rd, 1979. You'll hear from some of the Who fans who were there, along with the police, a city official, the Who's lawyer, promoters, the Red Cross, and reporters. The Who Concert, 30 years later.
I'm Cliff Radel with the Cincinnati Enquirer. I was the pop music critic for the paper, and I had been the pop music critic since 74 and had seen the city go from pretty much a wasteland as far as concerts go to this major stop on many, many, many major tours, thanks to the arrival of the Coliseum, which at the time was state-of-the-art, quite the draw, and many famous bands and performers wanted to play there, and The Who was one of those acts. They were a dinosaur, in essence, to many people's minds, because they were one of the supergroups from an earlier time, the era of Woodstock. At the same time, they were indeed a supergroup. And that was a big deal for them to be in town, for them to be playing the Coliseum. It was an event on the par of Led Zeppelin playing at the Coliseum. And it was another great feather in the cap of the concert bookers for Riverfront Coliseum to have that band come here. Because to put things in their proper perspective, before the Riverfront Coliseum was built, Cincinnati was a pass-by town, and acts such as The Who didn't show up. And when the Coliseum was built, it was built upon the promise that these great bands that everybody read about and heard about and knew about would be coming to town. And indeed, The Who did. They were originally booked for December 7th, and there was a scheduling conflict, and then the booking was changed to December 3rd. That day, I went down before the concert in the afternoon, because I had received a phone call from Mark Schoner, who ran the Ticketron outlet here in town, that there were more people than usual on the plaza level outside the Coliseum.
My name's Dale Minkhouse. In 1979, I was a lieutenant with the Cincinnati Police Division. My responsibilities for that day were the outside security for the Coliseum. Well, originally, we weren't going to start until about 5 p.m., but there was such a crowd gathering early that we started our police detail about 1 p.m. As I recall, we had 28 officers on the outside. Back in the 70s, rock concerts were pretty much wide open. There was an awful lot of pre-concert drinking, use of drugs. Not uncommon for the plaza level of the Coliseum to be covered with beer bottles, whiskey bottles, wine bottles. We had a lot of problems. For that particular night, our job was to monitor the crowd, try and maintain as high a level of peace and decorum as we could, pending the doors being opened and the crowd entering the building. At that time, the Coliseum had access points from several places on the street level. We had officers at the street level, at the ticket office for will call tickets. We had officers in the parking garages and also throughout the plaza level of the Coliseum. By 6 o'clock, the crowd was extraordinary in size. Between 6 and 7, we estimated there were 15,000 people assembled waiting to get in. That was a danger sign for us. Normally, you don't have that size of a crowd. And people waiting since 1 o'clock, there were a lot of issues. There are no public restrooms. People had concealed drinks, alcohol. A lot of anticipation. At that point, the Who concert was the number one group in the world. There were many people in the crowd. At that time, the Coliseum had a private facility up on the upper level that there was going to be a sit-down dinner. People that were going to attend that had to go through the same doors as everyone else. That dinner was supposed to start at 6:30. The doors did not open. So there was a lot of anticipation in the crowd. Those people thinking that they were missing dinner, that really kind of heightened their anxiousness. I have to get in, I have to get in. And the doors just did not open when they were supposed to open. A little while later, the group actually came and started doing their sound checks. So that music starts to filter out to the outside. It's very loud. Many people thought the concert was starting without them. And at the time, festival seating was permitted. So festival seating is first come, first serve. And that always had been just bedlam. People pushing, shoving, trying to get to be the very first people in front of the stage. So all of those things were contributing factors to the final tragedy that unfolded.
That day was sunny. There was a very warm sun. And there were many fans with tickets, some without, basking in that sunlight, leaning against what was then the white wall of the Coliseum's toward the entrance. And that was a very reflective surface. And there were easily 2,000-3,000 people outside spread around in the afternoon before the concert. I remember going through the bottom of the Coliseum to the press box, which was where I would enter and take the elevator up and go to the press box, set up. And back then we had a primitive laptop that was chiseled out of stone.
I'm Cal Levy, and I started working with Electric Factory Concerts in 1975. When I came back after a year in Los Angeles in late 1977, I was, for lack of a better term, the office manager and promoter. I was the on-site representative for the company. My boss, Larry Maggot, decided to come in from Philadelphia because the Who's manager, Bill Kerbishley, was on the tour. So Larry came in, and the day started with conversations with him when he got to Stouffer's. And then my usual routine, I'd go down to the arena in the morning, check with the production manager, make sure the breakfast catering had been taken care of, walk around the building, just say hello to the stagehands, and then go back to the office till about 5 o'clock when Larry and I went down to the show. I went and did my rounds, said hello to Richard Morgan, the building manager, walked up to the inside area of the plaza, which I always did a tour just one time around. Again, talked to my production manager, talked to the caterer, talked to a representative of the who told me that they might be late arriving at the building, but it shouldn't interfere with the sound check. We were only the second date on the tour, on that leg of the tour. So they were coming out of Pittsburgh, and as is the case in many, many tours, the first night loadout just doesn't go as expected. So things were running a little slower, a little behind pace from their standpoint, but nothing that anybody was concerned about. And then Larry went to dinner with Frank Wood up in the Beehive Club, and I sat in my office, waited for it to be showtime, which is what I always did. Grabbed a little dinner from the crew catering and just hung out. I got a call from Richard Morgan, the building manager. Prior to that, there had been a call on the radio that the ambulance, the paramedics that we had hired, that we always brought to rock shows on our own were needed upstairs. That was not in and of itself in a rock show a rarity, because some kids had a habit of getting too high. So it wasn't terribly unusual on a rock show to have somebody wheeled past us in the hallway backstage, because it's the only way they could get them outside, with oxygen, with a bag, needing assistance. If I remember correctly, about 7:45, I got a call from Richard that he needed to see me upstairs. That's all he said. And so Bo Wood was with me, and he said, "You want me to go with you?" I said, "Sure, why not? Don't know what's going on." And so I had knee surgery, and I was having knee problems. Tried to take the elevator, couldn't, because it was packed with suite holders and people coming in to get to the concert. So we walked the steps and walked out the door into the concourse and then onto the plaza level, where we saw, well, we didn't know exactly what had transpired, but what we saw was utter chaos. I walked outside and I saw emergency vehicles everywhere. I saw news crews everywhere. I saw shoes and coats and bits of clothing and bodies and people working on those bodies. And I just stood there, frozen. Saw the mayor, the new mayor, first day on the job, Mayor Blackwell. Saw him walking around, bumped into Dale Menkhouse, asked him what he knew. He didn't know much. He just said something about there had been some deaths on the plaza, probably caused by asphyxiation.
And I had written about this when Led Zeppelin came to the Coliseum. Before The Who, Led Zeppelin was here for a two-night stand, and I wrote a series of articles what situation was like inside the Coliseum, and that there was trouble ahead, and that people were rushing the stage, people were sitting in the aisles, there was a rush to the door, there was undisciplined ticket-taking, people were leaping over turnstiles, there wasn't enough manpower, and it should have been a more orderly process.
My name is Jay Patterson. I went to Princeton High School, and I graduated in 1973, and then I went to Ohio University at Athens. While I was home, I hooked up with some of my old high school buddies, and my buddies knew that The Who was coming to town December 3rd. So they bought me a ticket, and those seats sold out 90 minutes after the tickets went on sale. And I almost jumped out of my clothes. I mean, I was so happy. So the evening began with a group of old friends going to see another group of old friends, because The Who was like the soundtrack to our youth. When we all started raising hell and partying and driving around and doing the Tomcat stuff that you do when you're that age, I mean, that was right around the time Who's Next came out. That was in the summer of 71. And then, of course, there's Live at Leeds and Tommy and all that. I can't tell you how many nights we spent with that stuff blaring on the 8-track. We got down there an hour and a half before the concert was supposed to begin, and it was a madhouse. We were on the north side of the Coliseum, and it was just a sea of people. I couldn't believe that they had not opened more doors. Where we were, they had one half of a double door open. And then you look a quarter of a way around the circumference of the arena, and there's like another half of a double door open all the way over there. And people got more and more packed in, and it got to where you could hardly lift your arms. And then it was like a wave would go through the crowd, and I thought, if I were to lose my balance and fall here, I might not get back up. And like an idiot, I mean, we were all about half in the bag. We picked one of our friends up, and I put the guy up on my shoulders so that he could see better. And I said, "Are there any other doors open further around the hall?" He said, "No." So we tried to get into this little alcove area, and this slow crush of people slowly going toward those doors. And then I don't know how, but we finally got in. When I was pushed through the doors, my feet weren't even on the ground. I was just kind of wedged between people. And there was a cop inside waving his stick, yelling, "God damn it, get in. God damn it, get in. Get in. Get in. Get in." And I looked on the ground, and there were scarves and purses and shoes. It was weird. After having been outside that long time, I needed to use a bathroom. And I overhear this guy saying, "That girl was dead, man. That girl was dead. I know she was dead. She wasn't breathing. She wasn't moving. Her skin was all gray and clammy. She was dead." So I didn't repeat any of this to the guys that I was with because I thought, A, I don't know that that's true, and B, if it is true, there isn't a hell of a lot I can do about it at this point anyway. So find my seat, find my buddies, and let's do it. The first song that they did when they came out was Substitute, and the roof of that place just went off. I mean, people were like screaming. They were fantastic. I mean, they were absolutely fantastic. When we left the hall, I can remember piles of clothes everywhere. Coats, scarves, woolen caps, cowboy hats, jelly bean caps, baseball caps. But we didn't know what had happened until after we had gotten home.
My name is Carol Brown. I was at the Who concert in 1979. 1979 was a particularly odd year for me. I had graduated from nursing school. I was 22-year-old. Hair down to my waist, hippie child, flowers in my hair, big Who fan. The Who was coming. We got tickets. I, of course, was the only girl, as usual, who was going to the concert with a bunch of guys that I knew. And my brother went with us, my friend Dave, who worked at UC, a bunch of guys who either went to college at UC or were working there, computer guys mostly. It was chilly out, but not particularly cold for December. It was pretty cool at first. Everybody's having a good time. In those days, man, you packed a six-pack in your purse. You know, somebody always had bottles in their coats or something. You were always trying to sneak one in or sneak something over on somebody. I remember people were drinking on the plaza, having a good time, standing around waiting. And we were probably, I'd say, 30 or 40 feet from the doors because we had gotten there early enough because festival seating, you wanted to get in. More and more people are coming, and at first that was kind of nice because it's cold. So it's like, oh, good, I'm all warm and snug in the middle of this crowd. But I'm 5'2", so being in the middle of a crowd means I can't see anything that's going on. So my field of vision is completely, completely blocked at all times. And we were doing pretty well. The six of us are standing there, and we're all chatting about, you know, hope they do this. And, well, most of the guys I was down there with were in bands. So they were there not just as fans, but they're like, did you see what he did with that guitar? Did you see what he did? Did you see how he played that? So the crowd starts getting more and more compact. And now there's no more arms distance between anybody. There were these major surges coming from behind. I asked one of the tall guys, I was like, what is going on back there? And they said there were a bunch of guys at the back of the crowd who thought it was really funny to just run up and push people. And it was like a domino effect. And you could see like this wave of people. But there were cops like out on the fringes trying to get people to stop. And I remember there was this tiny little announcement that kind of went, the doors on the north side of the Coliseum will be open in 5 minutes. And that was it. You could barely hear it, but it was there. Two of the guys with us said, we're going to go around to the other side, see if that's any better, and we'll meet inside. Now there are four of us. It just keeps getting more compact, more compact. People are starting to get separated. You realize the exact moment when it became an out-of-control chaos. And I remember that at one point, I was not even touching the ground. I was completely suspended between bodies, mashed against some guy's back with my face in his coat, hardly able to breathe, one arm off to the right and up somewhere, the other arm to the left. My right leg was wrapped around somebody's waist and trapped between people, and my left leg was dangling straight down but was nowhere close to the ground. That was the most terrifying moment for me because I was completely not in control. It was the most terrifying thing. At this point, the other two friends who were there drifted off to my right. My brother had drifted off in the crowd to the left. I could kind of see where he was, and I saw his head go down, but there was nothing I could do. Crowd shifted and changed. I got a toehold on the ground, and we were kind of getting closer, but it was more like we were just compressing forward to the point where I could see the door frame. But at that point, it got even more compact and more compressed. And at this point, I can no longer really breathe. I can't take a deep breath. And I just am panting because I am mashed between all these men who are much taller than I am. And I can see the door frame up above me. My left hand got kind of out in front. And I just started yelling as loud as I could, "I am being crushed. I am being crushed. Someone please help me." A very large man in a yellow Coliseum jacket reached into the crowd literally and pulled me loose, turned to his right and blocked the crowd from like coming over the top of me and pushed me through the door and into the Coliseum. The first person I saw was my brother, and I asked him what happened, and he said the woman in front of him had passed out. She had fainted, and she was almost on the ground, and he got behind her, hooked his arms under her armpits, stood her up, and literally carried her into the Coliseum and had taken her to first aid.
All of a sudden, there's this guy standing over me, behind me, and it was the son of the publisher of the Enquirer. At that time, it was Bill Keating. And he said, "The newsroom wants to get a hold of you." There was no phone in the press box at that time. There was an intercom-like phone that connected to the house system, but there was no phone with an outside line. Private boxes had outside lines. Of course, this is the days before cell phones. So I went to the Enquirer's box, and there was the phone call waiting for me that they had heard a bunch of chatter on the police scanners about people down outside of the Coliseum. Could I check that out? Because I was inside the building. And they said, "Make sure you don't get yourself locked outside." So I knew my way around, and I knew which back stairways to take to get to doors, and went out, and I remember opening the one door, and there were bodies stacked like cordwood, and there were dozens upon dozens of pairs of shoes just piled up. Broken glass from one of the doors that, as a crowd pushed against it, plate glass broke. There were police, of course, lots and lots of police, and bodies being draped with cloths. It was a very horrible sight to see, especially because hours earlier, probably 5 hours, 6 hours earlier, I had been up at that scene, and it was a festival-like atmosphere outside. I mean, everybody was having a good time. People were sitting, relaxing. They were reading books. They were playing guitars. They were eating their lunches. They were laughing and having a good time. And now, at this very same spot, it was tragedy of proportions I never wanted to ever see, and no one should ever witness, of 11 people dead, and many injuries as well. As a critic, you put on your umpire's clothing, and you call them as you see them. So I had to write the review without any, and that was the decision was made. Do not, don't let the tragedy color the review. Just review their performance on stage, and so I did.
My name is Jay Aronoff. I'm from a town called Wyoming, Ohio, which is a little bit north of Cincinnati. I was a senior in high school on December 3rd, 1979, and in my class was a gentleman named Peter Bowes who was killed at the Who concert. I went with some friends. As was the tradition back then, we headed down, I think it was 2 in the afternoon, and that might sound crazy, but back in the day, that was kind of what you did. Actually, it was an event. My recollection is that not too long before that, they had released Quadrophenia, the movie, a cinematic version of their 73 album, Quadrophenia, which is my favorite of all of them, by the way, of The Who. We all considered The Who to be Daltrey Townsend and Entwistle, the bass player who recently just died. So there was a lot of anticipation leading up to the concert. Peter Bowes, my friend who was killed, I knew was going down. We had talked about it that day. We were both in this program at Wyoming High School together. I did not see him in the mayhem, but once you got down there, whoever you were with originally was not going to be the people you went through the doors with. Some people have the misconception that there was a, quote, stampede, where they picture this group of people, like, literally running over the top of their friends. That is absolutely couldn't be farthest from the truth. It was this strange anomaly where you had so many thousands of people together in the same area that the one person would slightly move one direction and would create, like, a domino effect, a chain reaction, could turn into a pretty big push by the next person, but by no stretch of the imagination was there a stampede and people running toward doors. It was quite the opposite. Everybody was packed like sardines. and just simply the natural sort of wave, is what we called it, was going on. And I initially wasn't that frightful of it because those waves were very similar to the waves that we would experience on the floor of the Coliseum itself. The Who were late sound checking. I remember hearing them sound checking, thinking the concert started. That did create sort of this mayhem. The other huge problem is there was one door open for the vast majority of the time. Once the doors were open, we're being like 7 o'clock. I just remember the fun ended and I started to get really scared because I had trouble breathing. I knew that if you fell down, there would be deep problems. I don't think you could ever get back up. And I got kind of lightheaded, and next thing I remember, I was on my back on the floor and somebody had broken one of the doors open, not to break into the concert, but to simply relieve the pressure. And I got thrown through the door by someone, and they probably saved my life. Unfortunately, my friend Peter Bowes, as I learned later on, he fell down and apparently never got back up.
My name's Gary Miller. I am presently the community and government officer for Red Cross in Cincinnati. During the time of the incident, I was disaster director. That night, I was responsible for coordinating the medical team and also the mental health people that were called to respond to the scene. We had just completed training back in March of that year of a medical response team called the Medical Assistance Team, or MAT. The MAT team is a group of volunteer physicians, nurses, paramedics that respond to the scene of a mass casualty incident. We did not have at that time a USAR team. We didn't have all the things we have today in place. So it was really a groundbreaking thing. And the MAT team made news all over the country because of the way that we responded that night. And also just before that with Beverly Hills Supper Club. The night of the incident, I happened to be at church at a meeting. My pager went off to call the Hamilton County Communication Center. And at the same time, I got a page to call the Cincinnati Fire Department. We had 50 pagers that all went off at the same time with the same information. I immediately called a few people to double check and talk to our dispatcher to make sure that the volunteer doctors had all been notified, which they had. And we were all converging on the Coliseum. In those days, we had no information exactly about what was going on, and there was not much coming over the fire radios because they didn't know either until they got there. And this was racing through my mind, the whole thing of thinking about where we're going to set up a triage, because it was cold. It wasn't freezing cold, I don't think. And trying to set up a triage area outside the Coliseum was probably not going to be a thing we were going to do, so we would probably move it downstairs. And I kept thinking of all these things. When we arrived, the police gave us a briefing as much as possible. I remember Dale Minkhouse was the lieutenant from the police department on duty that night, and he gave best a briefing as he could, but it seemed like most everything was over. But we were very concerned that if, and the police and fire were, that if some word got around or something happened that there might be panic. They had everything so well in hand that it was really easy for us to really look into things and start doing it. So we set up a perimeter of the whole area around the Coliseum with our medical people, police officers, fire. So we had a team around the place because we weren't sure how many other people were injured. And when I went into the first aid room, it was very obvious there were some people that had been killed. The first arriving physicians, two of them beat me because they were right downtown. And they were working with the EMS units. At that time, we had very few EMS units in the city. And we did have quite a few injuries. A lot of it was glass, people falling, and there was drug use. So we did the best we could of treating people. We had abrasion, cuts, people falling down steps, some people looking for friends that didn't get there, but that was very, very few people. The injured were taken to the hospital right away by the EMS units, or as we called them then, life squads. The people that were dead were, even though they were examined by the physicians at the Coliseum, they went to University Hospital to be pronounced, and then they went to the coroner's office. So we brought in our mental health team, thinking that this might be a rush on the place by parents. There were a few, but they couldn't get through to park, and they were at home on needles and pins. We continued up until the concert was over. We stayed there. Of course, as soon as they got outside, the word started with rumors and truths because they couldn't understand why there were so many EMS units and fire department and police. And then we just waited until the last people were out. It was quite an experience.
Well, in Cincinnati, it was felt that the festival seating caused the tragedy. That was one of the causes. The upshot was that festival seating was banned. Festival seating is the issuance and the selling of non-reserved seats. And you buy a festival seating ticket, and at that time, it meant you could roam around anywhere in the Coliseum. And most people with festival seating tickets would go to the floor. There was nobody with a clicker or a turnstile saying X number of people can only be on the floor. Fine. Even if you have a reserve seat ticket, you can get on the floor. So festival seating was come one, come all. Here we go. Let's race to the doors. Let's see if we can how close we can get to the stage.
I'm Michael T. Ladd. Me and my wife, Tiva Ray Ladd, were at the concert in 79. Of course, as we know, I came back alone. I remember when we heard the Who was coming to town, we was really excited. My wife and her mother went to Shillitoe's to get the tickets at the Ticketmaster back in the day. They stood in line for, I think, 2 or 3 hours, and we was all excited about it. And then the night of the concert, my mother had the children, Chris and Case. We was real excited about that night. We got up on the platform up out front of the Coliseum. You know, we was there a little early. We wasn't too far from the door, maybe 10, 15 feet. When the people, you know, started coming in, the crowd was starting to mount. I think, we heard a sound check go off on the speaker, outside speakers, and I guess everybody got that was wrote what was going on. I seen three doors kick open, and then suddenly two shut, and one in the middle stayed. And we felt push of the crowd coming around us, and before you know it, you're just off your feet. You know, it would go from side to side, and if you went down, that was all it was. Was when we went over, I lost her at that time. I was down for a while. I always consider myself damn near number 12. I laid across somebody, and I don't know who, and I hope to God it wasn't her. Actually, when I came up out of the crowd, finally, 10 minutes later, maybe, I don't know, my pants were down around my knees. I had literally squished the pee out of me, and I was had cuts on my hands and bruises from broken glass. I had made it to my knees twice, and I went right back down again because the crowd just wasn't through yet. You know, they just didn't get over it yet. I heard the word stampede a lot. To me, I was crushed. I mean, I wasn't stepped upon until right at the end there, when the last of the people got, because there was a pile of people, maybe even waist high. People had to got their legs up pretty high to stomp all over it, you know. When I finally got to where the people were easing up off of me, or the ones that could, people just finally got to roll through it, that's when you really got stomped on. So it was a tough road there for the next year or so. Back then I worked at Newtone. I lost that job about, 9 or 10 months later. I had drank myself out of that job. I mean, it left an impact. I've been to one thing in that Coliseum since, and I think it was a tractor pull a few years later. I've been to a couple of concerts since, but they were up in Dayton. But I had two children. I remember they went to a show down to Coliseum. But I remember my son called me from the show, and I think my daughter did too, let me know they were down there and stuff. And I'm, okay, you know. They were just calling to say, you know, I knew we're down here and we're all right.
I feel like I've come a ways from being damn near number 12. Been through a lot. I always said it ain't going to get my pride. It ain't yet.
That night at the arena, no one told them until they walked off stage what had happened. They were not told. They had taken breaks during the show, during a solo or whatever. Roger Daltrey would walk off stage or Peter Townsend. But no one told them until they walked off. Allegedly, they were devastated. They were tracked down by other Cincinnati Enquirer reporters at the airport. And also, I believe one of the Enquirer reporters even got on the plane with them and got a couple quotes. But it's not like the Who stood up there at the end and said, gosh, this is horrible, and our hearts go out to the families of our fallen fans.
My name is Craig Kopp. I'm the former news director of WEBN, now the news director at WNKU. In 1979, I believe EBN's call letters were on the Who concert. I was home battling a case of the flu, and I got a call from Frank Wood, Jr., the general manager of WEBN from the Beehive Club in the Coliseum, and he said, kids have died outside the concert. It's a bad scene. That was about 9 o'clock that night, 8 o'clock that night, something like that. I did not get home until probably 8 o'clock the following night. And I called up my partner at WEBN, Rick Bird, and said, I'm going to go to the studio and start nailing things down there. You go down to the Coliseum and give me a call. And at the same time, we were an affiliate for NBC Radio, which was trying to launch a youth news network called The Source. Rick called. He's on the phone. The Source at NBC in New York called. And I said, I've got Rick Bird at the Coliseum now. Why don't we both interview him now? Well, so you can get your stuff. So I did a three-way conference call. The Who was playing at the time. So it was so loud that I had to repeat the questions from New York to Rick. Rick was standing at a phone bank just inside the Coliseum, and as he described it, he was standing in a pile of shoes. People had been ripped out of their shoes. And Rick began finding officials to talk to. We kept hearing this. There had been a stampede. There had been a stampede. There had been a stampede.
And now a rock concert in the news. Thousands of young people had gathered hours early to get into Riverfront Coliseum in Cincinnati, Ohio. The attraction was the British rock band, The Who. Suddenly, one pair of doors to the Coliseum was broken open, and the waiting throng rushed inside, eager to get the best possible seats. In the stampede, 11 people were killed, 8 others seriously injured. Rock music fans everywhere were shocked. Observers blamed the tragedy on several factors. Most of the seats, 80%, were general admission. That meant the first fans into the Coliseum would get the best places, and that encouraged the rush. Also, many of the kids had been waiting hours to get in. Some had been drinking or using drugs. The concert went on as planned, but the members of The Who were badly shaken.
If it had happened inside the hall, I don't think I would ever play again. There is a kind of a football game, boxing match feeling to a rock concert, and it's what guys seem to get off on. You know, they like this high-end event.
The Who asked authorities to help make future rock concerts safe. And later this week, their concert in Buffalo, New York was. Unlike Cincinnati, all Buffalo seats were reserved. I'm Christopher Glenn with a rock tragedy in the news.
This early in the story, it became apparent from everybody who was there that Rick talked to that they had been standing outside this crowd of people, festival seating, first come, first serve, and too few doors opened. And from the eyewitnesses and the officials, Rick quickly concluded that the people had literally suffocated to death outside, crushed by the crowd. We got that story down, and then I started getting calls from all over the world. Somewhere I have a piece of copy, or there's still a piece of copy somewhere in the WEBN news files, emphasizing the fact that this was not crazed rock fans stampeding in some way, that they had been crushed to death in a crowd that didn't know that the people in front of them weren't moving. And I have sigouts, lockouts. I'm Craig Kopp. For everybody from Great Britain to Australia to Germany to radio stations all over the country. And at some point, I can't remember, it might have been Frank Wood who came in and said, you know what? You probably ought to be emphasizing at this point, since all of these people tend to tune into us after it's over, to call home and tell their parents they're alive. And I still get people who come up to me today and said, I pulled over at a gas station and called home to tell my parents that I was all right because you told me to. The next day, we kept feeding people from all over the country. There was a news conference that night. I believe Del Menkhouse was there, who was in charge of Riverfront policing, I think, at the time. They held a news conference. It became clearer and clearer and clearer that what had happened was one door open, thousands of people trying to get through it. And we pretty much spent the rest of our time just kind of nailing down that story. And of course, after that, it progressed to the banning of festival seating and will rock and roll ever come back to Cincinnati, that sort of thing. In the meantime, the Who went on and did their gig, found out about it, left town. They were playing Philadelphia the following week. The former news director of WEBN, Mark Shearer, was the news director at that time at WMMR in Philadelphia. And through his auspices, I got an interview with a couple of members of The Who and flew to Philadelphia a week later and talked to Roger Daltrey. Pete Townsend was not talking. Roger Daltrey was. So I talked to him, and he was very pleasant and shocked and still in shock, and talked about how they never would have performed had they had known and those sorts of things, and brought that home. And then I remember even having an hour-long conversation with Ben Fong-Torres, who was the editor of Rolling Stone magazine at the time, who was working on a story concerning that. And this is still a matter of great debate, but Ben Fong-Torres was going back and forth about how whether or not Rolling Stone magazine had missed something that was going on in the world of rock and roll, and that is that there were stadia across the country that had figured they were going to make their way with rock and roll as a way to make a ton of money, but they really weren't interested in the fans who were coming in and whether or not that led to a tragedy like this where the kids weren't taken care of. These weren't just dollar signs and ticket sales, but they were actual people coming to the show. And I can still remember getting a call from a busboy, I think at the Queen City Club, saying, "The Who are in our basement." They had to come back to be deposed. And so we went down and kind of staked that out, did catch glimpses of them, couldn't get near them.
My name is Dennis Miller. I'm an attorney in Cincinnati. I was retained to represent The Who through their insurance company and their agent out of New York. There was a lot of allegations that the band was late. That wasn't really correct. What happened was when the Coliseum was set up by the road crew, they rolled in early that morning and set up all of the instruments and all of the sound set. The Who were going to do a sound check. They always do a sound check before everyone. And that sound check took place around 6:30 to 7. They were inside the Coliseum in the dressing rooms earlier, probably by 6. And I think the concert was scheduled for 8 o'clock that night. So they went out and did a sound check. And I would have to say that sound check took place about 7 o'clock. And when the crowd outside, who had been waiting, and it was December 3rd, so it was probably pretty cold, they heard the sound check, because you could hear it from inside and outside. I think that's when the crowd got a little anxious about getting inside to get the best seats and started pushing against the doors. Pete Townsend, Roger Daltrey, John Entwistle, and Kenny Jones, and then their manager, Bill Kerbishley. We're pretty remorseful about the whole thing. I mean, they came into town in 1979 to entertain people. They didn't come into town to have somebody injured at one of their concerts. They were going back out on tour again, I think, the next year, 81 or 82. And obviously, they didn't want the stigmatism of this incident, the Coliseum, to linger on to the other venues that they were going to perform in. In the beginning, they didn't understand it when they were first accused of causing the incident, which was right after the accident. But after that, you know, things calmed down, and they didn't want to see people injured. They're just human beings like everybody else. Once you take off all of the facade of being The Who and the popularity, they were just four individuals and their manager and performed pretty well throughout the United States. They weren't responsible for selecting how the venue took place. Electric Factory Concerts, which had control of the venue and maybe 10 or 12 cities, actually determined festival seating at the time. Yeah, 1980, they flew in from England. I think we started on a Monday or Tuesday morning, and the depositions were completed by Friday, and they flew back out. The deposition was led by a very senior attorney, Walt Bell, who passed away during the litigation. Walt was a little flamboyant. He was antagonistic at times. He started out pretty antagonistic, but after that he settled down into the point where we were really trying to get the facts. There was a lot of attorneys involved, probably 15 or 20 attorneys. I think there were 26 or 30 injuries. Some of the attorneys represented more than one party. There was probably about 40 some lawsuits.
things changed after report, and business fell way, way off as far as concert business goes. A lot of acts just stayed away. There were numerous other findings and rulings, no open flames, limiting of alcohol sales, and you know, no one was going to be sitting in the aisles anymore. Rules by outside promoters and rock and roll act management used as an excuse to bypass Cincinnati. They'd make more money elsewhere.
Well, I'm Johnny Schott. In 1979, I was playing music in town and doing some, not really promotion, which is never exactly what I've done, but I did some event production work for not-for-profits primarily. We had done I'd done Summer Fair. I had done a thing called Give Peace a Dance for the Sane Freeze group, the Nuclear Freeze people. Certainly what happened that day has had an impact on everybody who produces events on any level. I was assistant stage manager at the Legend Valley Concerts, and we did an event in 1980. We had 50,000 people there, and you had a chain-link fence between them and the bands at the stage, and literally people would reach forward through the front two rows of people and grab that chain link and pull and just try to get closer. And people in front were literally what we used to call waffled, you know, where their face was sticking through the chain link fence. You know, you get in the crowd, you get, you know, you have a drink or you do whatever, and sometimes judgment is not what it ought to be. In fairness, as a person who produces 100 events a year or something now, you know, you're always cognizant of every little thing that could hurt somebody. And it's what I certainly focus on more than almost anything else. I mean, you want to do a great event, but you really don't want anybody to be hurt. And we've never had anybody hurt. We've never had anybody arrested.
Paul Wertheimer always said that there should be printed on tickets for rock and roll concerts, enter at your own risk. Let the buyer beware. Rock and roll may be dangerous to your health, sort of like what's printed on the side of a pack of cigarettes. Paul was a city official at the time. He worked for the city, and since the Who tragedy, has dedicated his life's work is crowd management. He tracks violence at concert scenes throughout the world. Paul Wertheimer became one of the members of the task force that investigated the Who tragedy. Paul was not at the concert, as he once told me. He says, I wasn't into the band, but he was there in its aftermath to see bodies on that ground that night. And that was enough for Paul to step forward. You know, every one of these public hearings, every one of these task force, whether it be Watergate or whether it be some other gate of investigation, has one of these bulldog investigators. Paul Wertheimer is the bulldog. And you talk to Paul and you think he's a sort of a character actor in that he's a very mild-mannered man, very soft-spoken. However, he turned into this bulldog with this investigation, and that set him on this path to continue investigating crowd behavior and crowd management and, sadly, deaths that continue to occur and injuries that continue to occur at concerts.
I'm Paul Wertheimer. I was public information officer for the city of Cincinnati under city manager Sylvester Murray at the time of the tragedy at Riverfront Coliseum. As public information officer for the city, I went down that night, perhaps about 45 minutes after the disaster, to be present to help other public officials, safety director, city manager, the mayor, anyone else who was there, coordinate the efforts of the city and make any comments they wanted me to make on behalf of the city. Following the disaster, the city immediately established a citizen task force. City Council directed the city manager to set up such a task force with a mission to make recommendations that would prevent another concert tragedy, public assembly tragedy of this type in Cincinnati. That responsibility fell on the city manager. I, as one of his assistants, was given the opportunity to serve as chief of staff for that task force, a task force that was at that time envisioned to last just a couple weeks, but actually lasted about 7 months. A former safety director of the city of Cincinnati was chosen to head the task force, Henry Sandman, and the rest of the task force members, of which there were eight, were all citizens. Sharon Fry, who was a student. There was Richard Fussner, who was director of loss prevention at Kings Island. There was Sally Harner, who was youth services planner for the Cincinnati-Hamilton County Criminal Justice Regional Planning Unit. There was James Keyes, Jr., who was an attorney. There was Mark Lubers, a student at Xavier University. Bert Luginani, former fire chief of the city of Cincinnati. Tom Seemers, who was president of Franklin Savings and Loan. And Frank Wood, who was at the time general manager of WEBN Radio. And then there was a rather distinguished staff, I thought, as well. Dr. William Denver, who was at that time the psychology chairperson at the University of Cincinnati. Leon Met, who was a training officer in the personnel department of the city. And Ellen Volk, who was a secretary in the city manager's office. And then I served as chief of staff. That task force met for 2 weeks, for approximately 4 months, to go through the issues surrounding the tragedy. We spoke to dozens of people, took notes, and the chairman, Henry Salmon, and I traveled around the United States visiting major facilities to learn what the industry knew about concert safety, about handling crowds, and to learn what standards and rules and regulations and guidance they followed. As a result of that, I prepared the task force report, wrote the report, which took me about 2 to 3 months anyway, and then it was submitted on June 8, 1980 to City Council. The fallout from the report was substantial. It was distributed worldwide. It got great reviews from the industry and from other agencies involved, organizations involved in crowd safety. It either supported existing City of Cincinnati legislation that had been passed after December 3rd, 1979, or it recommended additional legislation or modification to existing legislation. That legislation that Cincinnati passed through this period was landmark legislation in the United States and remained viable, much of which still is on the books today for Cincinnati. And as a result of the legislation, which City Council, of course, played a major role in, there never was any kind of incident similar to what happened in Riverfront Coliseum over the last 3 decades. And that can't be said for other communities around the United States and the world that did not adopt similar legislation. The report itself contained over 100 recommendations for concert safety and venue safety. As far as Cincinnati goes, I'd say it's relatively safe, except for places in Cincinnati that allow moshing environments, crowd surfing, or stage diving. Those are extreme dangers, and I know to some extent they're now allowed in Cincinnati without any kind of guidance or regulation. That's the most volatile crowd environment for concerts in rock and roll. Festival seating, standing room, is by and large the most dangerous crowd configuration. And I know it was a few years ago that Cincinnati overturned its ban on festival seating, which was a smart ban, and replaced it with what I think was another smart idea, and that was to adopt the National Fire Protection Association standard for festival seating. That organization of maybe about 76,000 firefighters and life safety people who set and recommend standards of practice and safety for communities around the country had passed a new rule, let's say in 1995, saying if festival seating was going to be allowed to be safe, certain extra precautions had to be taken. When Cincinnati adopted that standard, they removed pretty much the reckless exploitation that festival seating environments produced, which was a major contributor to the disaster in Cincinnati. They removed that problem. The Cincinnati Task Force report still remains, 30 years later, the Bible of crowd safety for concerts. I think there is some unfinished business in Cincinnati regarding the WHO concert tragedy, and that is there is yet to be constructed a memorial for remembrance of that tragedy that captivated America and the world and, of course, shocked Cincinnati. We need a remembrance to honor those people who died and were injured, and we need a marker that cements the contribution that the people of Cincinnati made towards crowd management and crowd safety, because the contribution now 30 years later still remained probably one of the best set of standards and guidance in this field of crowd safety. The work of city council at that time, the mayor, J. Kenneth Blackwell, and the excellent work of the Citizen Task Force on Crowd Control and Safety was able to take a tragedy that nobody understood at the time and nobody knew what to do with in America and set up and recommend standards and guidance to prevent a similar occurrence. In Cincinnati and in any community that adopted the laws and recommendations of city council and the task force has seen no similar tragedies that occurred on December 3rd, 1979.
Festival seating still exists to this day. Fact is, there was a Bruce Springsteen concert with festival seating on the floor. And thank God no one got killed. And the roof didn't fall in, and the concert went off. But there were all sorts of safety measures in effect as well, limiting the number of people on the floor. You have to show a ticket. Of course, once again, no sitting in the aisles, no rushing of the doors because the concert opened. That was another offshoot of the task force. The doors were opened at a certain time in advance of the concert. It wasn't one of these deals 5 minutes before the concert. Away we go, and we open the doors and fling them open and let the projectiles come in the form of people wearing sneakers. So X number of doors were opened, X number of guards were there and ticket takers were there at the doors. So it was an orderly process. It's under a totally different set of rules as opposed to being wide open and, you know, having two or three guys opening the doors and other doors locked and other doors with bars on them that you couldn't get in or couldn't get out. Entrances and exits are now open and there's multiple ticket takers and guards inside and outside. And it's a very orderly process, as it should be, to safeguard people's safety. You're not supposed to be killed when you go to a concert. You're supposed to have a good time. Time erases these kinds of things for people, and it hasn't happened to them. God forbid that it does. I know that I'm very cognizant of where exits are wherever I go, and how can you get out of here, and what's the tenor of the situation. And you must be cognizant of what can go on. And you look around, you look to your left, you look to your right, you look ahead, you look behind you, see where the exits are, and enjoy the show.
The tragedy at the Who concert on December 3rd, 1979, left a deep mark on a generation of rock and roll fans here in Cincinnati. A memorial to honor the victims and their families is being planned for this coming Thursday evening, December 3rd. You'll find more details about it on our website, wvxu.org. The Who Concert, 30 Years Later, was produced by Lee Hay, with technical assistance from Brian Powers, Kevin Orwinski, and Shake It Records. I'm Brian O'Donnell.
See you.